Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Substation podcast. My name is Tom Edwards, and I'm joined by my colleague, Emma. And we have a special treat for you today. We're joined by George Day from the Energy Supply Catapult.
Energy Systems Catapult.
Energy Systems, thank you. We'll leave the error in. I'm not perfect. We're still talking about market design, and we thought we'd... I was really excited to ask you on, George, because we've talked a lot about things like locational marginal pricing and green power pools and splitting out the wholesale market design. And I think we have talked about CFDs in passing, but recently the ESC put out a paper looking at the kind of future of electricity markets, and you've come out with something different, which was exciting and quite different from those other proposals. And so I thought it'd be really exciting to ask you about that particular thing. And I guess, first of all, it's probably a good idea to get an introduction of what is the ESC.
All right. Yeah. So we're an innovation body. So we're funded to a significant extent by Innovate UK, and we sit in that space between the sector, the SMEs, the innovators in the sector, government, academia. We're quite an interesting, quirky body. We've got quite a range of different capabilities, from sort of heavy-duty sort of system modelling through to consumer insights. And then we've got some people who also think about policy, which is my bag. Really interesting outfit. Do a lot of work with innovators.
Yeah. So not like so the other kind of traditional parties we think about in this debate, like the academics, National Grid, either industry parties, industry, or they're like business, like Energy UK or Scottish Renewables or something like that, but you're actually like an innovation funding...
We're not a funding body.
Not funding. Not quite like DARPA.
What's DARPA?
Is the American Defence and Research. Like, does thinking of crazy things...
Right. I think we'd love to be as well-resourced as DARPA. but we're not quite there yet. But we do some really interesting stuff, it's true. And I've got some, fantastic, really interesting colleagues.
The paper that I read was, I think it's the EMR 2.0. So that's Electricity Market Reform 2.0. So the original EMR is the kind of the thing that brought forward the CFDs. Knocked the renewables obligation on its head, brought forward the capacity market and the emissions performance standard. Mm-hmm. And I think in your paper, the thing that really interested me is the move away from the CFDs, because a lot of people, or at least commentators, say that, they were very successful in the past, but there's going to be a lot of problems with them in the future.
Yeah.
And your suggestion is a clean energy standard, is that right?
Yeah, it's basically quite similar to something that's talked about in the States quite a lot, a clean electricity standard. We called it various things over the months, including a decarbonisation obligation, but basically it's requiring anybody who's buying significant quantities of electricity to procure in the portfolio that they procure to meet a standard related to the carbon intensity or the carbon content. So progressively over time, you've got to purchase and contract for more and more zero carbon electricity. So it's a big sort of market-wide demand driver to drive demand for clean electricity resources. But it's not focused on one particular technology. It's around getting the portfolio right. So it's a mix of you need to be thinking about a mix of clean electricity plus the flexibility and the complementary resources that you need to meet the needs that you're serving.
On the face of it sounds broadly like the renewables obligation, so the old subsidy that we used to have here in Britain that the contract for difference replaced. How is it different?
So Yeah, it's got some similarities to the renewables obligation. Obviously, it's framed in terms of the decarbonisation outcome that we want rather than renewables per se. So you'd get things like carbon capture and storage in scope. It wouldn't be banded, and we would see that, one of the problems I think with the renewables obligation was that the concept got broken down over time because there were all these complexities around banding that were introduced that became quite unpredictable.
Banding was the just to banding was introduced to provide different revenues to different types of generators in the renewables
That's right.
obligation. So if you were an offshore wind farm, you got two certificates, but if you were an onshore wind farm, you only got one certificate. And I think if you were a biomass, you only got half a certificate. So that there was a that was the level of complexity that they added in, and that's what banding is.
And the other aspect is that we would see a case to link that the sort of trajectory for the standard, the carbon intensity or the carbon content that you had to meet, that would tighten over time and be explicitly aligned with the carbon budgets or with the 2035, get to zero by 2035 in terms of the carbon content of electricity. So that would give it a greater kind of forward predictability and investor credibility. That's the concept, at least. And I guess there are ways that you could think about how you might legislate for that to give it, extra investor kind of credibility.
And you said that I mean one of the things that your paper rightly accuses of the CFD is that it doesn't incentivize flexibility really in any way. How would you see a clean energy standard incentivizing flexibility? Would you have to would your standard be for every hour of the day so that even in non-windy periods there has to be a certain amount of low carbon generation, or is there like a firm contracting
Yeah, you'd
obligation?
need to. So there'd be a question about how you settle up over what time period you judge the meeting the standard. But I think what you would need to do would be to make sure that the underlying data was accurate in terms of time. And clearly, there's going to be some periods, as you say, when it's going to be more difficult to meet a certain carbon intensity than others, depending upon, the available renewable generation. But ultimately, because you've got to meet this sort of portfolio standard, if you're a purchaser of electricity, you've got to think about, yeah, I want to get, I've got to make sure that I've got a big kind of quantity of zero carbon renewables in there, but I've also got to meet the demand that I'm satisfying my customers, and so I've got to match that up with flexibility. So you've got this incentive around matching the demand side with the supply side, and you're kind of internalizing that system problem on the electricity purchasers.
And how do you do that? How do you place that obligation on suppliers?
I mean, it would be placed on suppliers. And potentially also, large off-takers might be some industrial off-takers who'd be captured by that, and they'd have to make sure that the portfolio of electricity that they're purchasing meets that standard. And obviously, you'd have to think about, over what time periods you do, the compliance is judged.
How do you place a flexibility obligation? Is it just a megawatt or a matching megawatt hour thing, or?
I wouldn't see it as having a separate sort of flexibility obligation. That's the
Okay.
idea, is that you're integrating those two.
Mm.
The incentive on the supplier would be, okay, I need to, if I can't, if I'm having difficulty to meet the standard by just because I can't buy enough flexible supply, then I've got the incentive to try and increase the flex on the demand side to match up with, say, I'm buying lots of wind resource. So you've kind of got they've got the incentive to combine flexibility wherever it comes from, whether it's from the demand side or through contracting for storage or other, there might be space in the compliance picture for them to contract for some CCGT when they need it, but there's only limited space for that, and that declines over time. So you're kind of creating that incentive to for them to put together a portfolio of net zero electricity plus flexibility that's going to combine to meet that standard. And that gets progressively tighter over time. So, in line with getting to net zero.
That's that key thing. I think that's a key thing there, because you could see a world where if it's not tight enough, it's not properly set, you end up in the same world where we've got REGOs now, where, as long as it's really windy in the winter, it doesn't matter if I'm using loads of gas in the summer, because I've got all my REGOs in the winter. So as you have to set that settlement window and those targets correctly to drive that flexibility, so you don't end up in a position where you're using your long wind in one season and shorter in another, and it doesn't matter because it all works out in the end.
And I suppose when we think about, in fact, when we think about the 2035 net zero electricity system target, have we actually nailed that down in terms of what that means? Does that mean that every 24-hour period has got to be net zero? I don't think so. I think we're imagining that that's got to be net zero, probably on an annual basis, I would imagine. So you're going to have some days when actually, yeah, we are going to have some CO2 in there because we need it. But there may be other days where that can be balanced off.
With the, if Drax's plans work, then there's going to be a huge amount of carbon being sunk into the ground that gives quite a lot of leeway, assuming that that works.
And crucially here, we're talking about flexibility rather than capacity. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, so there's a separate set of questions, I think, around how do you what's the requirement that you place in terms of capacity adequacy or resource adequacy or however you want to do that. So, that too could be done through some form of supplier obligation type approach. There've been, and that's sort of broadly there have been attempts to do that in terms of capacity mechanisms.
I think the French capacity system works that way, yeah.
And that's, I guess we're in sympathy with that sort of philosophically, but I wouldn't say that we've really majored on that as a sort of area that we've analysed it in huge depth.
So it's almost a separate thing, is it? There's almost the renewables, there's the flexibility, and then there's the capacity adequacy.
And I think that the nature of the sort of reliability problem is likely to change over time as we get deeper into the sort of decarbonisation journey. But I think that's probably a separate, quite complex set of questions.
And this is quite different from the Dieter Helm kind of proposal, where you have an all-in auction that does everything at once. There's some sort of super algorithm that's planning everything. This is more along the lines of you set that target beforehand and the market meets it through
I guess.
natural market processes.
Yeah, I guess philosophically, we'd probably, Dieter Helm's proposal was more about, a centralized procurement auctioning type approach to it. And I guess we're at taking a different tack on it in terms of a more decentralized approach, and maybe not specifying that, you've got to run auctions in this format on this sort of, and define the products in this sort of way, but actually let, if you impose this obligation, then naturally the procurers of electricity will, they may want to run some procurement auctions themselves, and they may want to specify those in ways that they judge are best. A best sort of design to help them meet the forward contracting that they feel they need to meet their obligation.
Or you can even see third parties running platforms that allocate energy to parties who are in or out of balance, on their obligation.
Yeah.
That I think that neatly ties into my next question, which is that this is going to be really dependent on counter. So if this is all about building new stuff.
Yeah.
So this design is going to be really dependent on counterparty strength.
Yeah.
And you know, if I want to build a new wind farm, I've got to find someone who wants to take my certificate or takes the energy to meet the standards. So the person, and I want them to do that for a long amount of time to secure my investment. So I need to find somebody with a big enough balance sheet who is going to be there for 10, 15 years. And we've seen in the market recently that there's been lots of trouble. Suppliers have not been strong enough to weather changes in wholesale prices. So how do you think you build confidence in these markets that are typically quite illiquid to bring that capacity forward? And this is also a bit more complicated than a CFD. How do you make the generators happy with both the contracting that they have to do and that the market is going to be slightly more complicated?
Yeah, so I mean, I guess the first thing is that the overall idea is to kind of create a long-term sort of clarity that there is going to be a big market here for zero carbon electricity. You know, so we've said we're going to have a zero carbon electricity system by 2035. We've also got policies about, you know, we're not going to have new ICE cars on the road, allowed to be sold in after 2030. You know, so there's these drivers that are pretty firm, pretty trustworthy, that investors in renewable resources and zero carbon electricity, I think, can be pretty confident that they're going to have a market for their commodity. So the question is how much certainty do they need? You know, do they need absolute revenue certainty for 10, 15 years? Or actually, do we want them to be actually taking some more market risk, because that actually incentivizes them to think about, okay, how do I manage that? Actually, should I be investing in flexibility resources to complement my renewables output to help me manage my market risks? Or do I want to do that, contract to do that, for others to do that? And so you're creating this dynamic where the financial markets start to develop. I always sort of think that the CFDs, yes, they've done a brilliant job in getting the cost of capital down and getting the offshore wind supply chain going. And that's been fantastic. And we said that in our report. But now we're at a different point. And actually, should they be, you know, exposed to more of the risk of the market and creating the incentives that, by exposing players in the market to risk, then that creates the incentive to either develop the financial contracting mechanisms that people feel they need to manage their risks, or for the sort of real economy side of that, which is the actual physical hedges, so storage, demand side flexibility, and so on, to help manage those risks. And so that's the concept.
It's the issue of, I don't think the energy market, as it looks like, so now, who is it? What kind of party? Are there any kinds of parties that are missing from the market that would be needed?
I think there are. I mean, for this thing to work, you know, it requires well-capitalized counterparties. I think that's right. Quite how well-capitalized? You know, I don't. Yeah. You know, do they need to,
we're not going to expect Avro. No one's going to sign up to a long-term deal with Avro, a Avro equivalent.
Right.
But maybe, you know, do we have Statkraft or Centrica?
Hang on, Avro? Is that one of the small suppliers that...
That's one of the small suppliers that exited the market. Yeah.
Well, I mean, this is the other question is, I suppose, maybe investors have become used to government-backed contracts.
I think so.
Do you think that expectation... Like, will they ever be able to leave that?
I think we actually need to get out of that dynamic where we are at the minute, with relying on government-backed contracts for everything, because we then end up with this sort of cycle where, okay, we've not got enough of technology X, or we need some more long-duration energy storage, and then we end up with a contracting mechanism being bespoke designed for kind of each different technology category, and I don't think that's a very helpful dynamic. One, I don't think it gives actually from an investor certainty point of view, I don't think it's that great actually ultimately. If you're thinking about investing in things over a 10, 15 year time frame, you're thinking about innovating to develop new technologies that meet system needs, and you don't know, well, what contracting mechanism is going to be invented for my particular technology category. I don't think it's that great. I think it means that you end up with, the sort of system integration job is not being done by some of the people who are actually able to. Probably better place to do that than Bayes sitting designing new auction pots,
Yeah.
ultimately.
They're not power systems engineers, I'm
Yeah,
sure they'll
exactly.
be happy to admit that, yeah.
So I feel that, and this is what the catapult sort of argument is, that from coming at it from the point of view of innovation, especially, are we really likely to get the innovation in the types of, it's not only technologies, but it's also business models, because it's business models, consumer offerings, these kinds of things are going to, innovation in that space is going to be how you unlock some of the demand side flexibility. So are you really going to get that through relying ultimately on a series of centralized sort of state-backed contracting auction type mechanisms to sort of Lego build your generation bricks over time? That doesn't feel like actually that's the right way to go it. Now, there may be some big bits of the generation mix, nuclear is the obvious one where you're going to need some, probably you're going to need some big state kind of intervention there. We're talking about nuclear RABs and things like that. But there's still a huge role, I think, for, kind of putting in a policy framework that actually encourages buyers and sellers of resources of electricity to contract and resolve some of these issues for themselves. And part of what I think the concept we were trying to develop was also around, to get this thing to actually really work, you need the forward contracting, you need financial market development, and that's part of it. And when we wrote our report, we were probably a bit vague about that, but we were very conscious that that's part of the picture. And I think that's where, some of the debate is how do you move from this kind of almost infantilized, maybe that's a bit pejorative, but where you've kind of got the state does all the revenue stabilization for you. How do you move from that to something where actually, no, you've got to grow up a bit. You've got to take responsibility for sorting out those risks yourself. So you move incrementally over time, I think, I
It's
suspect.
not just giving them a bit of a leg up and a bit of certainty over time. It's also protecting them from being exposed to penalties, being exposed to the costs, the balancing costs that they create.
I was going to ask there, with that kind of long-term market view, how do you think that works with, do you think this kind of investment framework works with things like locational marginal pricing or the green power pools? Do you think that they're complementary, or is there, do they break each other? Are they synergistic or antagonistic?
So, on locational marginal pricing, I think they are, that, in fact, in the original report, that was part of the package that we proposed was, getting your underlying sort of real-time price signals kind of more accurate, if you like, or more granular in time and space. And so LMP is part of that, so that you're getting price signals, sort of spot real-time price signals that reflect the physics of the system more accurately than they do at the minute. So that's important. And then the sort of obligation approach, I think, means that the purchasers of electricity have got to be, obviously they want to be buying electricity in the right places because they're facing locational pricing, So that's an important part of the picture. And then they've also got this dilemma to resolve around, forward contracting and matching up the sort of zero carbon resource that they've got, and the compliance problem with flexibility to meet this, to match up with the demand that they're serving. And then they've also got to kind of think about, well, okay, what flexibility should I be getting on the demand side? So your sort of your energy service providers, I call them energy service providers in this sort of world rather than suppliers, because they're not just people who are putting a logo on the bill. They're actually doing a complex function. And they've got to think about how, trading strategy. They've got to think about the consumer offerings. They've got to think about, forward procurement. There's a lot of, they become quite, they need to be sophisticated businesses to survive in this world. And that's what we actually want, because we need those businesses to help, one, drive the right, procure the right mix of stuff, because you're requiring them to do that, but also to work with consumers, to give consumers great offerings in terms of, smart control and real, maybe time of use deals or whatever, different deals that consumers might want. And also they will have an interest in helping consumers to decarbonize as well, because that matches with their own decarbonization obligation.
So this energy service provider has to buy its financial transmission rights, sign CFDs for each of these nodes. It then also has to work out its obligation, and it's got to submit all of this, gather all of these demand side flexibility and its generation portfolio, and submit that into the central clearing algorithm. It's going to have to be a big, punchy company with a big balance sheet and very lots of staff and sophisticated.
Technically savvy. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not the supply company of my day of a spreadsheet and a out the
Yeah.
box
Now
settlement
there
system.
may be some niche people who can come in and serve niches in this and do very well in this world. There may be some people who will decide, oh, actually, I need an element of vertical integration here.
Yeah, it does sound to me like this is
And there may be others who will, who will focus on, being the trading, kind of digitally sort of empowered trading house, if you like, that's going to help to resolve these things. So I guess we're agnostic about exactly what sort of corporate structures and what sort of the businesses might look like. And to some extent, as long as we get the outcome, which we've kind of defined in terms of the way the clean electricity standard or the obligation, whatever you call it, is, as long as you get that, then the actual corporate strategies and the corporate structures that deliver that, that could be a range of different things.
because it's almost moving the obligation to look after the consumer onto the supplier more strongly, isn't it? Like it's giving them a greater incentive to care about decarbonisation system needs, whereas at the moment, arguably, suppliers are not necessarily incentivized to think about those things, well, as much as they should.
I'm just. I think that's right. It's certainly taking the sort of taking a much more sort of demand led, trying to take a demand led approach to delivering decarbonisation ultimately. If you like, if you think maybe sort of EMR1 was about sort of pushing renewables and zero carbon onto the system, kind of almost in tension with the underlying market. This is kind of okay, let's actually reshape the objective function of the demand side of the market to want all this stuff.
Exactly, yeah.
One of the things that I think is quite interesting here is because your suggestion is quite different from a lot of the others. I'm not sure there's much it could be built on. How long do you think it would take to implement, and Do you think that would have any sort of delaying effect on reaching the 2035 target?
I don't think we have the answer to that, if I'm absolutely honest. I think when we wrote the report, and as we've done work that's kind of to look at elements of it in more detail, we've been clear, you know, we don't want to create, you know, the idea is not to create a big investment hiatus, and there would be obviously, you know, existing things that you've got to honour, etc. And there's, you can't just move overnight. You can't just throw out the CFDs overnight. And there's probably a process of adapting the CFD mechanism to perhaps expose people to bearing more market risk, if that's appropriate. But I think ultimately you could get to something that's quite different to the current set of arrangements, and signal that. Again, a lot of this is around signaling the direction of travel early and sort of saying, you know, people already start to respond before actually policies are implemented formally. And you've seen that when, you know, this is a bit like a long dated sort of regulatory standard, you know, that's introduced with kind of advance notice. And I think you'd start to influence people's strategies, how they were thinking about projects and the sort of balance of investment that they should be making, even before you kind of got all the formal arrangements in place. I think what you'd need to go along with it is you'd need to develop, you know, much better accurate carbon tracking through the settlement processes. And we did a report on that with Elexon a while back, looking at what that would need. And I know there's some really interesting innovation going on, energy tag. There's a trial looking at what's needed in that. So you'd need that. I think that there's a kind of overlap with the Michael Grubb green pool power idea is this idea that you maybe need some active development of the forward contracting in the financial markets. If you're going to take away the state-backed, you know, revenue stabilization mechanisms, then you probably need some sort of maybe some active, proactive market making or you know, interventions.
When they were designing the CFD, they had to put in the idea of a supplier of last resort.
Right.
The off-taker of last resort, that's what it was called. So that everyone who thought, oh, I don't know how to get a sign up for a PPA with a CFD, everyone was told, well, don't worry, there'll always be a backstop, even though no one ever actually used it because the market kind of went, oh, this isn't hard, and dealt with it. So if you create that backstop, like you could have the green power pool or an off-taker of the last resort kind of thing that sits behind that, just to say.
And that's the area where we, you know, to be honest, I think there's more work to be done on that. You know, if somebody was to say tomorrow, oh yeah, this is a great idea, we're going to go with this concept, then, you know, actually working through the details of how you implement it would be around those sorts of issues. And I we'd love to do some more work on thinking about, well, how could that work? What might that work like? It's not an overnight fix, but I think it's not something that is not resolvable before 2035 and in time to impact on 2035. And I should also add that 2035 is not the end of the story by any means, you know. I was looking at the numbers for, you know, the size of the electricity system. I think, you know, are we looking at something like a 400 terawatt hour system in 2035 on some of these, you know, scenarios? And then it's kind of got to get to 600 or maybe 700 by 2050.
As about 600, 700 by 2050.
So you've still got a massive amount of investment. You know, that, and the shape of that investment needs to be driven in the right way all the way to beyond 2050. But, you know, if you think about it in the 2050 timeframe as well. So I think you kind of need to look at, you know, actually what's the sort of long term way we want this to work.
What about the interaction with this proposal and the wholesale market? How might you expect those two things to kind of work together, and what kind of impacts might you see?
So I guess over time, talking with someone earlier about this, is you'd kind of want the wholesale market to become more important and less important at the same time. So more important in the sense that because you're reforming the price formation process and you're getting more locational signals in, and maybe if you move to shorter settlement periods, so you're getting more information into the about system value into the wholesale market. So it becomes more important in that sense. But because you're also creating these incentives to forward contract as well, that ultimately this comes back to this issue that we've got currently around the role of the system marginal price in driving consumer prices, is that actually because your service providers are contracting forward for a lot of their portfolio, the portfolio of resources that they're supplying to their consumers, that the wholesale market is about resolving the kind of finer matching of supply and demand in real time, and actually the average procurement costs are the more important thing that flows through into bills. So that's sort of, that's the kind of way that we'd imagine it working. But I think how it would actually pan out in practice, obviously, is, nobody can predict that in detail.
Do you have any examples of this work, or this or something similar, working in other markets? Because I'm aware in America that there are similar standards. There's also like long-term PPAs with big corporates. That's kind of what I'm imagining. This is probably the most similar thing we have in the GB market now to what you're talking about. But a lot of the problems I hear there are about like shape and forecasting and getting the right product available. Because like a big corporate generally tends to want like a big flat piece of demand, and then this isn't going to look anything really like, or what, is that going to be available? Are there any lessons that we can learn?
I'm sure there are lessons that we can learn, but I don't think there's anywhere in the world that has done the full Monty job of this. So, very similar. When we were sort of doing the research for the Rethinking Electricity Markets report, we looked at other jurisdictions. There's a very quite a similar sort of concept was developed in Australia around, I can't remember what they called it, the sort of energy guarantee or something they called it, but it was ultimately quite a similar concept. And you're right, there are kind of aspects of this in play in North America, and you've got certain in certain states in the US you've got cities who are forward contracting for their electricity as well. There's federal regulation which they can sort of enact to give that power to cities to forward contract. So you've got sort of more active forward contracting. Just reading the trade press in the US as well is quite a lot, because they don't have, they've got a lot of renewables projects, but not benefiting from the UK or European style CFD or feed-in tariff type policy support. So you've kind of got more financial intermediaries and forward contracting arrangements supporting those projects as well. So there's aspects of it, but I don't think anywhere has kind of, gone the whole hog, as it were, in terms of what we're proposing.
Do you think smaller participants, smaller generators, because this is, I think, another accusation that might be levied here, is that for smaller or more decentralized assets, this is a more complicated process. Is that necessarily fair, or you can guess by my tone that I don't think it's a fair accusation, but
I don't know. I mean, I think it's pretty the whole electricity landscape is pretty complicated at the moment, isn't it? We'd hope to achieve some degree of simplification through this, although, when you get down to implement things in practice, they always end up getting to be a bit more complicated than you ideally imagine them to be, and when you first dream them up. But I don't see what I mean. I think that with LMP coming in, for example, that makes, that gives much more of a local dimension to the market, and so, and that incentivizes, generators where we really need them to, with particular characteristics that we really need to come onto the system.
I guess the concern here, well, I guess if we're leaving this mostly to the market to develop, we're setting the obligations and then we're allowing market forces to bring forward the volumes, etc. Comparison might be drawn with the wholesale market, where there's been historically concerns about, forward liquidity for smaller players. So I suppose I guess that comes back to the point that we mentioned earlier about whether you need a market making obligation as a backstop to kind of help that along.
And that's the area where, I think there may need to be further thought done on that, how that might work. One of the things I thought about, and again, it was partly prompted, I think, by, reading the Michael Grubb type green power pool idea. I mean, I agree that you may need some active development of standardized contracting, maybe ways of aggregating contracts as well. That might be a function where, something like the low carbon contracting company might move out of being, the counterparty for CFDs, but into doing that sort of work in terms of actively trying to develop the financial markets and some of those maybe standard contracting approaches, maybe market making of some kind. So that feels like that probably will need that probably does need something, and that may change over time as well.
So we talked about the differences to the renewables obligation, and we've kind of touched on some of the differences to the existing subsidy regime, so the contracts for difference. What are the key benefits, I suppose, of this proposal compared to what we have now?
I wrote a blog that was looking at this in terms of the trade-off between cost of capital and system integration benefits. So when we published the report, a lot of people say, well, that's, taking away the revenue stabilization is going to push up the cost of capital. And so we said, well, yeah, it might do. That might happen in the short run, particularly probably erode over time as financial markets and contracting mechanisms developed. But the benefits in terms of system integration look potentially really material, worth billions, potentially tens of billions of pounds a year on the cost of the system in 2035, 2040, 2050. So if we get a policy and a market framework that really helps us to drive an efficient mix that works in real time, a mix of resources, balanced mix of resources, that's worth a lot in terms of the overall system cost that ultimately consumers or a combination of consumers and taxpayers will end up having to pay for in the, 2030s, 2040s, that sort of time period. So, well, you just have to look at, some of the differences between the scenarios that are out there in terms of different generation mixes, quite different scenarios, but the system integration benefits look big. The other aspect in terms of advantage is also around the demand side, and we think there'd be much stronger incentives for innovation on the demand side, for unlocking the demand, getting a more active demand side into play. So yeah, we'd see those as the sort of key benefits.
You mentioned a mix of resources, but also, as I understand it, this proposal would be technology neutral. And in that case, are you just relying on the market to deliver that mix of resources? Are you expecting that that will come forward when you set the obligation and then take the hands off?
I mean, I don't think it means that you don't need early deployment support or innovation policy support for, particular technology categories which you which we can be fairly sure that the system is going to need. So, it doesn't mean that, BEIS can stop all innovation policy or innovation support. Yeah, you need that, but that needs to be ring-fenced and done through a different set of mechanisms than the sort of mainstream market. And differentiating those clearly is quite important, I think.
But yeah, thank you for coming on, George. I really wanted to talk to you about your model design because it was different and
Different and sensible, I think. It's not so mad. Like the Green Power Pro makes my
it
mind
kind
just
of
implode a little bit because it's such a deviation from everything I've known about market economics. Whereas this, I feel like I can get my hands around.
I also like that it's kind of in the tradition of GB market design, which is choose one thing, do the opposite, then do the opposite again. So it's kind of like, oh, well, we didn't like the RO, so we did the CFD, and then we'll go something that's a bit more like the
A bit
RO,
more like the
and
RO. Okay.
yeah.
I liked it. I mean, I've spent some time arguing that it's different to the RO, but I can see, structurally it has some similarities, but
Yeah. It's a mandate obligation. I, that's the that's the that's the bit. But that's it's just my I think yeah. I like the idea that for some reason GB always does this thing where it vacillates between two wildly different market designs. Anyway, yes. Thank you for coming on, and thank you for listening. You can find us on at Substation Podcast on Twitter or email us at substationpodcast@gmail.com. Otherwise, you can follow Emma at Energy Burns or me at Notional Grid. George, would you like to tell people where they could find you if you want them to?
So I am on Twitter. I don't tweet that much, but I am at GeorgeDay27 if people are dead keen.
Otherwise, the you can find. I guess we can put a link to the blog that you're talking about from the Energy Systems Catapult in the notes, and yeah, that you can download the report from their website and find out more there as well.